Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In episode 8, season 1, I speak to the incredible violinist Kersen Leong. At the beginning of the episode, he performs a movement from Isai's solo sonatas. And in this discussion, we really hear how reflective he is. It was a very deep and broad discussion, and I found it really inspiring. And he also gives great advice for all musicians. So all of these interviews are available in video format as well, and the link is in the description of this podcast. And please follow this podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts so you can find out about all the new episodes coming out with a wide range of interesting musicians and their lives in music. Hello, welcome to Violin Virtuoso Kersen Leong.
Hello, thank you so much for having me, Leah.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation, but I know that you agreed to play some music for us at the beginning.
Absolutely. So I thought I would just play a little movement from Isai, so one of his six sonatas for solo violin, the fourth. This is the first movement, so it's funny since each sonata is dedicated to one of Isai's colleagues. Mm-hmm. And of course, this one is dedicated to a name that I think we all love very much. Fritz Kreisler.
That's right.
So this is the first movement from that. It's called the Allemande.
Thank you so much. Take your time.
Thank you.
Wow, thank you so much. That was completely transporting. You really captured a lot of kind of the improvisatory feel of these pieces.
Absolutely. Well, actually, this is it's nice that you point that out because for me originally, the reason why I actually got interested, very interested in exploring the whole set of sonatas in depth is, in a way, it was I saw the opportunity to at once be sort of grounded completely musically, to have to establish some sort of overall architecture, but also to have this foundation, but in the end also to push, I guess, some certain creative impulses as well, that somehow these pieces and their characters, they allow me to do that within a certain established sphere, I guess. So that was actually, for me to be at once reverent, but also creative in a sense.
Eugène Ysaÿe, Belgian violinist, not everyone knows who he was. He was actually a pretty interesting musical figure.
Absolutely. So he was a very, you could say, legendary figure of the first half of the 20th century. In fact, I think one of his, I forgot exactly who it was, but one of his esteemed colleagues that said that he was probably the first violinist in history to play completely in tune or something. But he was very much like considered the first modern violinist, where he laid down, I guess, a lot of the foundation for a lot of, I guess, the technical expectations, but also the kind of perhaps pointed the way for the sound world as well, that we find ourselves in. And of course, throughout the 20th century, he was very much an influence on many of his younger colleagues, from, I guess, Milstein, for example, called him the Tsar, so the Russian, I guess, and for king of the violin. So he's very much an esteemed figure. And you could tell by these sonatas, but also just like in general, he was a very, in a way, prolific composer as well, that had many different ideas, interesting ideas. And you could tell also that he was quite ahead of his time. For example, I guess even taking one of his violin sonatas, the fifth one, you almost get the sense that that he's very much ahead of his time. It's very abstract. It allows for much exploration, I guess, and creativity in a way. It's looking into the future very much. So yeah, definitely a figure I think that I would love to more people to know, I guess, and also to hear his music. Because for me, I think, well, the when it comes down to it, I was just mainly very struck by the musical language. It was something that hit very personal for me. So the idea to record the six sonatas after performing them several times in concert was inevitable for me.
So talk about where you recorded them.
Yeah, so this recording I recorded a few months before the start of the pandemic, actually, at the concert hall of the Domaine Forger, which is sort of on the shores of the St. Lawrence, in deep in Quebec, perhaps, I guess, an hour and a half or 2 hours north of Quebec City. And it's a wonderful place. They have a wonderful music festival, music academy, and they have a wonderful concert hall as well that's acoustically excellent. And so it was really a luxury to do it in such a place, and also with such an excellent producer as well, with Carl Talbot. I worked with him for my very first album, actually, a few years back, called Bis. That was a collection of encore pieces or short pieces with piano with Philippe Chiu. So I really enjoyed my experience. Like, it was a very enlightening experience working with that. So it was an obvious choice to work with him again. And so what we actually did was that we stripped down all the curtains on the walls of the hall, which is already very reverberant, which is very alive sounding. But we made it almost even more in the direction of a cathedral in a way, by stripping down to have more hard surfaces and concrete, for example, that we could really just create this atmosphere that was very appropriate for the vision, I guess, that I had for these pieces. And also, I guess, Carl's idea of my sound as well. It was very much a collaboration in that sense. So we recorded it in a space of 4 days, the six sonatas. And it was just a a wonderful, you know, one of those experiences that you, that is so intensely personal in a way that you wouldn't forget for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. You know, even though, of course, I think I was physically and mentally and emotionally torn apart by the end. But I think those are one of those, you know, those moments that you go through that you're like, okay, these are the moments that define, you know, that define my life, you know, in a way. So, you know.
And you have a personal connection to Isaïe in that your mentor, Dumé, studied with Milstein, who studied with Isaïe, right?
Yeah, basically, in a way, it's actually, it's funny because, of course, Isaïe can be considered as part of the sort of the Franco-Belgian school of violin playing. And actually, both of, in a way, I could be considered through the, if you want to call it the lineage, you mm-hmm. could say, as part of that as well, through, of course, Augustin Dumé, who I worked with for 4 years in the Queen Elizabeth Music Chapel in Belgium. In turn, of course, he studied with Milstein and with Grumio as well. Grumio was also a promote with one of the Franco-Belgian school. So in a way, it's definitely a sound world that I feel very close to, I think. And also having grown up with, you know, the great players of the 20th century. I mean, those were always recordings and always images that were around when I was growing up. And, you know, of course, my tastes have greatly diversified since, but it still remains a very, a sound world that's very familiar in a way, and that's very close. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I can draw from, I find, very, very naturally at this point, is the kind of ideals that, let's say, they would have had, or I would perceive in that era of playing or that style of playing, you know, the texture and the sound, the development of notes, you know, even within individual notes, just such mm-hmm. development and such texture and such layering. I think there are certain aspects, you know, whether you want to call it, I think, old fashioned or not, but I think there are certain aspects in that, you know, that you perceive in sound of players of that era that I really take inspiration from. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And your time, you were artist in residence at the Queen Elizabeth Chapel in
yes.
Waterloo, Belgium. So, and Isaïe founded that.
Absolutely.
It's a
absolutely.
Pretty special.
He founded that actually with the institution with Queen Elizabeth of Belgium. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Queen Elizabeth was also, I guess, a very much a violin enthusiast and music lover. So in a way, it's pretty amazing to, you know, having, let's say, been aware of Isaïe's music and, you know, from a certain distance. I mean, of course, we were all in the violin playing world hear of Isaïe's name at some point. But then after a certain while to come to a place that is so directly linked to such a composer and to such a history, I guess, that really fascinated me a lot more and definitely played a huge part in my interest in these sonatas and wanting to record them for Alpha Classics. So,
but your experience at the Queen Elizabeth Chapel, it's not a regular music school by any stretch. Can
you
speak to that?
It's definitely not a regular conservatory or regular institution with a curriculum. It's actually more, I would kind of characterize it as more of a stepping stone institution in the ways like, you know, you allow for professional experience, or I guess like, you know, getting used to giving concerts and kind of collaborating on projects and collaborating with whether it's your fellow young musicians or with people who have much more experience than you have, you know, for example, Augustin Dumé, but also Gary Hoffman, for example, Miguel da Silva, Louis Lortie, was of course also Canadian. And so that was a really cool institution to be part of. And I mean, there was also this aspect of the symbolic, I guess, that symbolized professional life, professional experience, but also this very private side as well, that because the music chapel itself is situated in the middle of a forest almost, mm-hmm. You know, and that's just on the edge of a town called Waterloo. So that's the Battle of Waterloo, you know, where that's, I guess, that's where it's famous from. But so it's very, it's a very secluded, in a way, very calm area, and also has state-of-the-art facilities where you can actually really, that at least for me, it really allowed me to go inwards, you know, and to have the time and the space and the peace to really explore things in depth, but just within yourself, your own relationship with the music, you know, and that I think was extremely consequential, you know, in the sense that it gave me the awareness of what was actually possible, you know, with that kind of intensity of looking inward, you know, what can come out, you know, what kind of revelations would you have? And I think because of that, it was a very, very fruitful time and experience.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about your interpretation of Bach. I got to hear the recent solo recital that was broadcast on behest of the Scotia Music Festivals. Amazing, amazing recital. Thank you for that. And I'm going to say pleasantly surprised. I didn't expect your Bach to be that, you know, full of color, Baroque color. I just expected it to be more romantic, honestly. Mm-hmm. So what kind of influences did you have when you're studying in Europe?
Yeah, so basically, I think like for me, when it comes to something like Bach or Yezai, stuff like this, I think it was very much for each of these separate repertoires, I guess. It's a very personal, or I guess I have a very personal way of approaching it, I guess. But certainly for Bach, I think, you know, of course I was influenced at the beginning. I heard pretty much the Bach cycles by Schering, for example, by Grumio, by Milstein. You know, of course those are powerful renditions that you can never really forget. You know, but also I think recently I've just been really inspired by, you know, the kind of the excitement that's going on in the Baroque scene at the moment as well, especially what I've seen in Europe, for example. There's such an energy and care, I guess, that is very inspirational that I find in this kind of you know, new Baroque approach that I find is really that's really influenced me a lot. I think also it's a lot about having really started to listen to organ music, for example, mm-hmm. or just sort of, I guess in general, I'm very influenced by keyboard music and the mm-hmm. purity that comes along with it, or at least the purity that I perceive, you know, that, and I very much, this sense of purity and this sense of essence, like stripping down things, I think has also very much influenced my Bach playing a lot. And also when it comes to choir music as well, mm-hmm. there's a certain, yeah, I guess it's there's a simplicity to it, and yet there's a real all-encompassing aspect. And so I try to, I guess for Bach, encompass that in the sound, mm-hmm. you know, capture that element of simplicity, but also that expansiveness that can come with that, you know, and to try and strip things down to its essence, I guess, as I see it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess, and of course, that would also have influenced my Yezai playing. Obviously, there's a direct link as well, because Yezai was directly inspired by Bach. Mm-hmm. Three sonatas and three partitas. So six for Bach, six for Yezai. And the first sonata was directly inspired by performance of the Bach G minor sonata, so the first sonata. So everything is very linked. Of course, it's a completely different sound world, you know, that allows for a lot more, I guess, you know, consistent with Yezai's time, or that kind of sound world that allows you to wear your heart on your sleeve, perhaps, or mm-hmm. be a lot more, in a way, extroverted expression or intention. Expressive intention. However, there is also that expansiveness and that sort of that purity that also comes along. Mm-hmm. I think so. In a way, they've both. It's very interesting for both approaches to be very distinct, but also for them to have very, very many things in common as well. So, yeah.
So speaking of different sound worlds, during the lockdown, I know you did some really fun arrangements that you've put up on your YouTube. Beautiful Oblivion by Piazzolla. And I believe you're playing viola in that as well.
Yes.
Have you played quite a bit viola in chamber music?
I haven't yet, actually. Mm-hmm. I've maybe, the closest that you could call, I guess, chamber music with viola, I did with Jonathan Crowe, for example, several mm-hmm. years ago. I mean, this was a long time ago, perhaps. But of course, and Jonathan is a former professor of mine and a very dear friend now. And we played Passacaglia together.
Okay.
It was the very first time that, even though it was, I think, for a small house concert, but it was my first venture, mm-hmm. if you could call it that, I guess, into the viola world, you could say. I just find that, you know, for me, the viola, of course, it's of the same essence of the violin, you know, but at the same time, I find that it gives me this ability to separate myself from a lot of, let's say, established notions, you could say, or things that already are. It just gives me another avenue to explore, perhaps, other concepts or other sound worlds, mm-hmm. or even other styles that I'd be interested in. I just find it's kind of like, you could call it my guilty pleasure instrument.
Yeah.
You know, I do play it quite a bit in private, mm-hmm. you know, at my own leisure. But I think, you know, it's just something that I love using for that kind of exploration. I think for me, though, to, let's say, play classical repertoire or play chamber music repertoire with the viola, I would give myself several months of a good chunk of time to settle in, to develop the kind of sound ideal mm-hmm. that, you know, that you would if you would be playing your main instrument. You know, mm-hmm. that's something that's, I think, a respect that you give to the instrument, but also to the music that you play. So that would be sort of that would be what I think about that. But for now, I think it's definitely something that I love to just explore new things with at my leisure. You know, it's very much that guilty pleasure instrument. So.
And when you make arrangements, are you doing it on a keyboard? Are you hearing everything in your head? How do you do that?
Yeah, so I think it definitely, of course, you would have to notate it somewhere. So obviously I have a sort of a MIDI keyboard
for
that, which helps a lot. But it usually just comes from, you know, when you hear something and you kind of let your imagination go wild. So it's like, you know, different representations of the same atmosphere, or the same idea. So I just try and sometimes I just sort of let it go almost, let my imagination go, you know, let myself be as creative as I can, or kind of be very almost casual about it, you know, even though, of course, you know, everything I do, you know, is there's definitely a weight to it. You know, everything that I want to do is something that I really do believe in, for example, even if it's something like a simple arrangement, that I do want to do also the whatever the material justice as well. So, yeah, I it tends to happen all in the head. Then I try it out, for example, and if something works, if I like how things, and sometimes, of course, I have to see if things fit together. You know, let's say if there's many different voices in one, then I find, okay, does this work? Does these two work together? Then I just go like that, and then I start to notate. And it's a really fun process. I think it's really stimulating, and it also allows me to free myself, I guess, in many different ways. You know, and also free myself from the instrument as well. So I think that's actually something that very much throughout is a general goal, is to, in a way, when you make music, to transcend the instrument, or to you know, make yourself or other people forget about the instrument, but just to behold the music itself or the idea itself. And I think doing arrangements and letting my mind run like this, I think is a great way of reinforcing that.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a balancing break too from all the woodshedding we have to do.
Of course, yes, of course.
And you have a really interesting connection with physics.
Yeah, so that's actually it's something that started with my dad actually. So my dad is a physicist, and he just after a certain while, of course, he was always very much a music lover, but after a while, he started to take interest, like going to observe different musicians, for example, different violinists, or to observe what they say, but also try and start to make connections between what would first seem as ideas that would be contradictory, let's say, you know, or expressed differently, and to find connections in a sort of from a scientific point of view, and also learn about, or I guess he taught me a lot about how things actually function, like how the string behaves when it vibrates, and you know, what would be, for example, the optimum way to excite it, and to how to think about it. So I mean, all these things, of course, I wouldn't consider myself at all a physics expert, definitely not, but I think a lot of these things that my dad has sort of, I guess, experimented with me with, I guess, and have really influenced, like, just like the practical, the way to apply these ideas. I just would find my own way to perhaps interpret these ideas, and that would influence my playing a lot. And to the point where actually several years back, my dad and I, of course, he would use me as a sort of guinea pig, which is actually kind of cool. It's very interesting. And, you know, he gave together, I mean, me as the guinea pig, and he, you know, he gave lectures about the subject, for example, in Beijing during the Menuhin competition in 2012, mm-hmm. I think, in some universities in California as well, and in Norway as well. It's something that I constantly think about. Like it's not something that perhaps I'm aware of, or I try to think of specifically, like the scientific aspect while I play. I mean, it becomes a natural process, but it's still something that evolves, I guess, and also evolves my approach as well constantly.
Mm-hmm. The strings, they vibrate sideways, right? Like
they actually, like in a way, it's very cool, because when you see this sort of when you see a string vibrate, actually there's a kink that kind of goes around. Mm-hmm. So it is Helmholtz motion, basically. And it's incredible. It's almost as if the string is turning. It's like it's just sort of going around in a loop. There's a certain kink that goes, mm-hmm. you know, throughout the whole length of the string and the whole amplitude, and it just sort of goes around and goes and spins and spins. So I think there's whole this idea that really that actually over time made me think of, let's say, the bow action or bow motions, less as, let's say, a straight point A to point B, but actually more as a constant sort of transformation of energy. You know, whether it's a storing of energy or it's the release of energy. So anything, like even like a certain, no matter how, you could say, how sharp the articulation, how soft the dynamic, how fast the note, how short, how long, it's all the same sort of, I would try and think of it always as a transformation, or like a transformation of energy. So everything kind of has this release to it. I think that's a lot of it. A big key to sound production, especially the projection, let's say in a concert hall, is that it's basically releasing a lot of the energy that's built up, not just sort of transferring it onto the instrument with force, so mm-hmm. to say, but to find the way through not just relaxation, but controlled use of tension mm-hmm. as well. I mean, that's a very big, it's a controlled release of tension that can create that kind of release in the sound. And I think you can, it's definitely something that you can perceive in the sound as well when sound is properly released. So
yeah, we can definitely hear it in your sound. I'm curious about a couple of ways you have of working. Do you have basics or warm-ups that you tend to keep doing, or have you kind of dropped that by now?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think I focus a lot these days on sort of this, like the speed of physical transitions, mm-hmm. like especially in like for example, in the left hand, the speed of, let's say, anything from finger dropping or finger lifting, you know, to change notes, mm-hmm. shifting, even stretching, you know, but all to do it so that, and to do it at a speed, let's say to work it up to a certain speed where it becomes very active, very impulse, almost like an impulse, you know, that there's the least amount of sort of big muscle activity mm-hmm. involved in making such small actions, because there's simply no need, I think. And it really does sort of keep me very, very, just very reactive, you could say. That I feel focused on a lot. Let's say when I slowly get back into playing, let's say to recuperate after a long concert the next day, I would also start slowly with that and slowly work my way to make sure also that there's less, not more tension that there needs to be yeah. also in certain parts. And I always just try to also, when it comes to the bow arm as well, like just to make sure that there is, it's sort of like dividing things into, you could say, infinitesimals, kind of like, you know, to make sure that in every instant of the bow, you know, that you absolutely know exactly what you're doing, you know, and you focus really on that. You allot, let's say, a period in your practice where that's really the main focus. Whereas otherwise, when you're actually playing, it becomes second nature, it becomes something that you don't think about. But I think that sort of, emphasis on body awareness, mm-hmm. I would say. That's something that I would say is very, makes up a big, big part of my warm-ups. Yeah, so.
I'm impressed because you're young and you obviously have such facility from such a young age that you have that analytical side, because you've produced these really great YouTube videos talking about technique. And I think that's great, because if you just rely on the instinctive part, at a certain point, if things aren't working, you know, then it's a lot of work to figure that out. Because at a certain point, we're always our own teachers, right?
Absolutely. I think there's certain things, because I think it's also, you know, the kind of experiences or lessons that you take from growing up or just from life in general. I think there was definitely, definitely seeing, I guess, looking back in the years, for example, when I would be, you know, transitioning from, I guess, the 13-year-old or the 14-year-old that just having one menu in competition mm-hmm. is starting to kind of do that. But then, of course, transitioning from that to, let's say, when you're 15, 16, when you become self-conscious, when things, you know, things you can't really sort of, or you lose certain things, you don't understand why, you just become less fearless. I think those were very much low points in my life as well during that period. Mm-hmm. You know, there were certain things, certain circumstances, I guess, during those times that would really force me to just look inward and look at my own body and try and really sort of understand certain things for myself, you know, without, of course, having it be like a constant obsession. But I think it was more just like a way to cope with myself, like mm-hmm. to always... You know, I think, of course, you know, with artists, I think we're always in a contest with ourselves. We're always very much looking at ourselves with a critical point of view, you know. And this was just a way, I guess, to process that in a healthy way. And so a lot of this technical work, and also just the technical setup, and you could even say, I guess, the technical style as well. And, you know, the way I do things stems very much from that. It's just the general idea of finding myself in times when, you know, you feel the necessity to, you know, because you're losing yourself. You had one version of yourself, for example, when you were a so-called young kid, young prodigy or whatever, but then that would fade away. Then you would have to find what is really the essence within yourself. And so I think, you know, the technical aspect, the analytical side of playing was just one aspect of that. Yeah.
No, it's just I had a nerdy question. One thing you said I found super interesting, you mentioned about the thumb that needs a certain strength, and you talk about its independence. And that was like a lightning bolt moment for me, because all I've ever really heard people talk about, including I think Galamian's book, is just like, keep that thing relaxed, right? And it's always about relaxing the thumb. But of course, there's counter pressure and we do need strength in the thumb. And for me, one of my problems is it has a tendency to get in the wrong position, you know, and I have to keep reminding myself, you know, get that where it needs to be for my hand to work properly, because I have a super small hand.
Right.
But what did you, if you could elaborate on that a little bit more about the thumb.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was basically talking like from the position that I think if there is certain, I guess if there's a, it comes from the aspect of security in a way. Like sometimes, of course, we are afraid of, let's say, just the thumb slipping or kind of losing position, of course. And a lot of that, a lot of subtle tension could arise just from that fear alone. And I think that, you know, I guess the strengthening aspect is to increase security, is to just basically assure yourself a little bit more to make sure that your thumb is able to respond to subtle changes in the left hand. Especially, I think, like, even just going one step back, I think it really stemmed from my experimenting with playing without shoulder rest as well.
I was just going to ask about that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually a huge technical topic for me. I think it was one of the, if not the most consequential for me, was to stop playing with shoulder rest. I think it was around when I was 16 or 17. So maybe around 8 years ago, I would say, that I made that decision. It was less about removing the shoulder rest itself, but it just sort of, I guess, made me realize what a world of technical subtleties and things, especially in the left arm and left hand, especially if you think of, let's say, holding the violin as a balance of responsibility between the left hand, the thumb is a big part of that, obviously, and let's say the shoulder or collarbone, that there's just a whole wealth of things that you end up learning that you had no idea existed before, because the shoulder rest did a lot of it for you, you know. And so, yeah, I guess the thumb, I just find that, yeah, if it lacked the strength, the kind of elasticity that comes along with it to be able to adjust quickly to different position changes, then there can be, you know, there can be an amount of tension that can build up either, you know, in this part or even further down the arm that we may not realize. And so I think that was a lot of, that was something that, you know, I felt like this sort of, sometimes you would feel the kind of tension, you would figure out why, but then you would actually end up just doing some random thumb exercises, for example, even just like to be able to curl the thumb, to curl the thumb, and to have the security of able to, let's say, curl the fingerboard or curl the neck with your thumb without any of the other fingers involved and without a shoulder rest involved. I think that's immediately something that gives perspective and not only, you know, strengthens the thumb, makes it more kind of, you know, feels more warmed up and more reactive, but it just, it's very much assurance as well. So, yeah.
And I just want to ask you about your process of memorization for new music.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, for me, it's been very hard to actually, to express it concretely. It's been something I've always been thinking about, like, how do you explain it? For me, it's always been quite an intuitive process. I think it was just, you know, when you hear a piece of music, then you're able to sort of map it out. But actually, what makes the mapping possible, or at least what makes that what starts the process, I guess, is when you think more in the bigger picture. In a sense, it's not only the sort of the harmonic functions in the piece, but also like the feelings or the specific sensations that those harmonies give. And in a way, it's sort of, I would imagine it's almost like, you know, let's say if an actor is memorizing, let's say, a play or something, and there's, of course, you know, pressure of delivery, and, you know, there's all that, all these factors that combine, that it's like one word that appears that immediately opens the door to another paragraph. You know, that those are the sort of markers that set in your head. And I think very much the very personal perception of color that comes from harmony, from analyzing it, I guess, grouping it into bigger, you know, those kind of harmonic changes or whatever, is very much like that. One feeling sets off, you know, another section and reminds you, okay, this is what comes along with it. And so that would be the way, like, for example, when I was, you know, performing Bartok's second concerto, for example, which is quite a difficult one to memorize because, you know, it's quite a lot of different things. It's also not, it's, you know, things are not predictable. A lot of times you have to rely on muscle memory to execute the passage work. But for me, it was like to try and really, of course, you practice the individual practice passage work, but then you try and group it into a way, especially with harmonic language as rich and as like mind-boggling and as evocative as Bartok's. I think that was very much a help, I think. So yeah, I guess that's the best way I could describe it. It's that one harmony, you, let's say, select one harmony or one feeling, one sensation that immediately becomes a marker for another section that helps you navigate. So
that's very interesting. And upcoming projects, what's coming up for you?
Yeah, so basically next month I'll be performing with the Les Violons du Roi. It's just, I'm very excited. It'll be the first time that I work with them. Also, I'm going to be performing two concerts for Toronto Summer Music, as well in Toronto with virtual concerts. One chamber music concert on the 27th, I believe, with Stéphane Détrault, cellist, and Angela Schwarzkopf, harpist. And also, of course, the other concert with the National Academy Orchestra, where I'll be performing Mendelssohn Concerto, as well as a modern concerto by composer Avner Dorman. So, yeah, very excited. I mean, I've been very, very lucky, actually, during the pandemic to continue to do occasional virtual concerts. I mean, these are experiences that, you know, once you have this particular perspective, that you miss a lot of these things. Obviously, you never take any of these things for granted as well. It's just such a nourishment, and in a way such a privilege as well, to make music and to make music with colleagues as well. So I'm just very, very excited, very happy, and fingers crossed for next season. I think things are also things are starting to sort of happen again, I guess, but so we'll hope for the best.
Yeah, there'll be links to all your upcoming things in the description of this video, as well, of course, your website, which will be updated. So if people listen to this later on, they'll see what you're currently up to. And just finally, do you have any words of advice for aspiring virtuosos, for children out there working really hard who really want to be Kirsten Leong?
Absolutely. Well, you know, for me, I think it comes down to, like, when I look at my path, you could call it. In a way, a lot of things happen in a very non-linear way. Mm-hmm. And I think, but a lot of those, let's say, things that were set into motion were because, you know, of course, at a certain age, when you're young, when you enjoy doing something from a particular perspective, and let's say you become good at it, it becomes fluent. But I think when it comes to, let's say, becoming not just a virtuoso, but an all-encompassing musician, and a serious musician at that, is when, for me, at least, I recognized there was a moment when I was 16 or 17, when suddenly music making became personal. Mm-hmm. You know, that it wasn't just a fun activity anymore, or in some cases, what felt like a chore. Mm-hmm. Or an obligation, or just something that you do as extracurricular activity, whatever it might be, but it just suddenly became a necessity for life, you know, mm-hmm. for living, for, you know, the exploration of yourself, you know, and just a necessity for growing up as well. So I think the most, what I could say from that is just the most important thing is to, and I think a lot of it happens not only, of course, with music education, the importance of that, but also the importance of the mindset that you have when you practice. I know that, of course, when you're young, you know, practicing may not be the most natural thing, may not be the thing that you want to do the most. But I think it's very it's a worthwhile thing to find pleasure in little details.
Yeah.
To be very to just find fascination with things that, you know, over a period of time you may take for granted or you may get used to. But I think it's that mindset of fascination, of constantly being, you know, yeah, that pleasure that also drives, I guess, the want to get better and the want to explore more. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I would say, just take pleasure in the little details and to really find a personal relationship with the music. You know, find perhaps music that you love to play, you know, work towards pieces of music that you loved, that you would love to play. You know, I think that that would be, I guess, in my mind, the ideal way to go about to start, at least. So yeah, enjoy and really find your connection with the music.
It's great advice for all musicians, amateur or professional. You speak so eloquently about music. I found this conversation really inspiring. And thanks so much for playing at the beginning. Of course, people can hear your recordings and hear the beautiful sound of the Domaine Forget Hall as well. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Leia, for having me.
Season 1 of this podcast had 20 episodes, and Season 2 continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.